From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
No surprise, probably, that I get a lot of questions from readers and listeners about invasive species. And lately, a week doesn't go by without at least one of you asking what to do about so-called crazy worms or Asian jumping worms, which more and more of us are alarmed to be finding in our garden soil. They're also the topic for today's program, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Away to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere.
My guest, Brad Herrick, is arboretum ecologist and research program manager at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, where the staff first noticed the destructive handiwork of Asian jumping worms in 2013. He's been studying them ever since. And Brad, I'm so grateful that today you're here to sort of give us the researcher's perspective on this really challenging and frankly terrifying pest. How are you?
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You must see a lot of you must have encountered a lot of different issues as an ecologist, I mean. And so where does this rank? Is this a pretty startling one?
Yeah, it's definitely right up there, and it's one that was, you know, right under our noses, but we didn't realize it until, like you said, 2013.
Yeah.
And that's when my background is in plants, and so I didn't know a lot about earthworms. Definitely didn't know the different types of earthworms, and we've discovered it 2013, and from then on out, we've been on a campaign to learn what we can and help others learn as well what to look for and some of the impacts.
So, I mean, to just kind of backtrack, of course, you know, we gardeners were always taught, oh, earthworm equals good, right? Because,
right,
you know, they aerate the soil and blah, 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 and leave behind rich castings and so forth. But things are really changing. And so you said you didn't know a lot about earthworms, but I bet you do now. So these are kind of the latest invasives. But in the northern United States, especially, we don't really have a lot of native earthworms, do we, of any kind?
That's correct. Yeah. Pretty much anywhere that was glaciated during the last glaciation, depending on your latitude, around 10,000 years ago or so, are pretty much devoid of any native earthworms. Here in Wisconsin, all of our earthworms are, for the most part, European species, and more recently, this new line of Asian species.
And so you knew you had earthworms, of course, always at the Arboretum, but you didn't know you had these Asian species. And sort of what was the moment? I mean, I can tell you the moment that I experienced them when I had this aha, but what was the moment for you? What was it like? What was the telltale signs?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So what happened was that we were a site for a conference. It was called the Ecological Restoration Conference. The society, and they were here in Madison, and we held a field trip for folks, and we had some help from the DNR, from their earthworm biologists, and we came out and talked about invasive species in general, and mostly about plants, and she gave a short talk about invasive earthworms, and we actually went out to one of our wooded sites here at the Arboretum, and dug around for folks to show them what European earthworms look like, and talk about what they can do to the leaf litter and the soil and the structure and the plants. And she mentioned just kind of offhandedly that, oh, yeah, we also have this new group of earthworms from Asia that we don't have in Wisconsin yet. And they're just kind of, we know that they're around, and we think they're going to be a really big problem, so we're really working hard to keep them out of the state. And not a minute later, she wiped back some of the leaf litter, and we saw maybe half a dozen of these snaking, squirming, wiggling earthworms that had a really weird behavior, and right away she said, oh my gosh, this is what I was just mentioning. This is the new Asian earthworm that, you know, until just now I didn't think we had. And so that really kicked off everything. And, you know, since then we've been working closely with our Department of Natural Resources, garden clubs, master gardeners, other folks from other states, academics, to learn what we can and do as much outreach as possible on these critters.
Well, I think what's scariest, and I mean, of course, all invasive species, whether plant or insect or, you know, another organism, you know, a pathogen of some other kind, they're all scary, and we hear about, you know, one or another, but a lot of times they're specific to like a species or a genus, but often, to, you know, it's to a species or a couple species. And so that's horrifying enough, you know, emerald ash borer, okay, or whatever. But this is like it's a pest of the precious soil that all plants rely on and therefore we all rely on, right? So this is in some way, this pest freaks me out in a way that, I mean, not to say that we could necessarily say, oh, what's the worst or better, you know, grades of bad. But,
sure.
But this, because this attacks the soil, and I wonder if we could just sort of talk about that. The mechanism that's going on that throws things out of balance, because again, we all thought, oh, earthworms were good. They deposit these castings, but these guys, they live they live in big congregations and they go too fast. They do the work too fast. What happens?
Yeah, that's a great question, Margaret. So, like you said, you know, for a long time, for decades and decades, we've been taught and gardeners have known this, that earthworms are supposed to be good for your soil, especially for your gardens, urban gardens, and that is true for a specific group of earthworms and in specific types of gardens. And so, for example, you know, the European nightcrawler, kind of the one that everyone knows about, those actually are really good at aerating the soil because they create these deep pores, these deep pore space, and so they mix the soil, they create, you know, channels and tunnels in the soil so that water can get to the roots, and they can really break up what can be often compacted urban soil. And so that can really help plants grow in a garden setting. But what's really different about these suite of species that are primarily from, you know, East Asia, the Korean Peninsula, and Japan is where they're endemic to, is that they don't, most of them, the ones that we have now in North America, do not burrow down very far. They spend their entire life cycle in the top few centimeters of soil.
Oh.
And so they're not providing any of those, you know, deep-dwelling benefits, turning the soil over, you know, mixing nutrients. They're not doing any of that. They're doing all their work in a very small space in the soil profile, on the very top. And they do it quite well. They do it very well, actually. They eat all the organic matter as much as possible, usually in the form of leaves or whatever organic matter you have on the top of the soil. They consume that. And then, like you mentioned earlier, they produce casts, which are their poop. And those casts are really rich in nutrients, and that's usually a good thing for gardens. But what happens, they produce it so quickly, and they make available those nutrients so quickly that it's often lost to the plant because, you know, after the next rainstorm, those nutrients are leached away. And so it's kind of like if you think of a quick-release fertilizer, lot happens right away, and it happens too fast for the plants to really take advantage of it. And so you end up with soil that's actually has less nutrients in it. And that can affect plant growth and plant establishment.
Well, and I've read in the last couple of years since I first learned about these worms, I've read that they're not only in the Midwest, and I know like a number of states are Minnesota, I think, Wisconsin, Michigan, I don't know which other states have a problem with them. But the Southeast, the Smoky Mountains park, right? I mean, in the Smoky Mountains, they have an issue with them. In New England, we have increasing reports of issues with them. And I've read especially in the Great Lakes Forest, I guess that'd be north of you, is that right? Is that what I want to say?
Yeah.
So that they can actually create almost like what I've seen referred to it as like tree root gingivitis, like where they destroy the tilth, I don't know what you'd call it, of the soil, and stuff can't even hold in the ground. Like they've wasted all the organic matter so quickly that the succession plan of these natural areas, like in the Smokies or the Great Lakes, is not happening. Like even in native areas, forget a garden. It's bad enough that a garden is being destroyed, but these natural areas too, yes?
Right, right. And for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, that's really their big concern is what can we do to keep these critters out of, you know, our national forests, our nice pristine state forests. And you're right, and that's what's happened with the European earthworms, too. People don't think of European earthworms or as earthworms as being that bad because they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. You find them, you know, in your backyard. You find them in forests. But, again, where there were glaciations in the Great Lakes, for the most part, although these states were almost entirely glaciated, the plant communities that came back after those glaciers receded evolved without any presence of earthworms. And so it's a disturbance in the ecosystem. And you're right, these earthworms, whether they're European or Asian variety, they will literally consume the duff layer, which is that organic, spongy, highly nutritious layer that plants need, especially when they're germinating and getting established. And they'll get rid of it, and it'll end up going right down to the mineral soil. So you're really left with very little nutritious soil that can hold roots and get plants started. Even trees have problems when you reduce that buffering spongy layer and you start to see buttressing roots. And that can also fit. There's a lot of research now on the feedback between when that disturbance happens, it often opens the pathway for new invasive plants like garlic mustard and buckthorn to come in. And it's sort of a vicious cycle that once you have a real major disturbance, you know, native plants tend to get excluded, and same with, you know, native soil biota. That's been shown in the Smokies as well, that some of the native arthropods don't do well in the presence of especially these new group of earthworms.
Well, and it's like what's left of the soil is just its mineral content. Is that correct? Because the organic matter is gone.
In the high abundance area.
Yeah, they really waste the soil. And compared to much smaller organic matter processing creatures, whether microbial creatures or even small insects, these guys just go that are sort of detritivores, right, are our debris recyclers in a forest community. These are big, hungry, fast-moving, fast-processing guys. And so they're just, as you said, they're taking that duff layer, all those years of fallen leaves that were meant to slowly decay and be, you know, crumbled up and, you know, little organisms worked on them gradually. It's not happening. It's just being voraciously consumed and wasted quickly.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. I mean, they're really good at what they do. And we've done some research recently that's shown that they not only you know, consume that organic matter, they can also move quickly between years. They can spread into uninfested areas, and they can outcompete or displace other earthworm species, even if there are other non-native species, like European species.
Right.
So they have not only are they hungry critters, they're also very good competitors in other ways. And, you know, we don't know what the mechanisms are for how they displace other earthworms or what that might mean long term, but it's again we just don't know a lot yet about this suite of species, and so that's some of the work that we're doing here at the UW-Madison Arboretum.
Sometimes for me in a garden setting, I wasn't, you know, looking under the leaf litter like your colleague at the Department of Natural Resources who came on that tour, you know, and discovered them. But what I noticed was these little looked almost like molehills of coffee ground like soil particles. Does that make sense? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so there's, right, you know, some of the European earthworms, like I mentioned, the deep-dwelling ones, will create these little midden piles, they're called.
Middens, right.
Middens, yeah. And so those, if you're seeing piles of, little piles of soil, often with with kind of skeletal leaves stuck in them.
Mm-hmm.
Those are going to be European species. Those will not be the Asian species. But if you see more of a uniform coffee ground-like soil signature, very loose granular, that is a telltale sign that you have this other Asian variety.
Well, all around the edges, That's what I was seeing, like the edge of beds, for instance. Instead of seeing those little piles like you're mentioning that I had known in the past from time to time, it was like at the edge, it was like there was just coffee grounds coming out from where the turf met the bed. Do you know?
Yeah.
It was really weird. Cool. And when I lifted it and I looked and they were these snake-like, their movements were more snake-like and they were big. And it's just, I mean... they're so destructive anyway. So before I just keep complaining and complaining, so your research then at the Arboretum, how do ecologists such as yourself and other researchers, how do you even all sort of get together and say, hey, this is what we need to do. This is what approach we're taking and our colleagues over here are going to take that approach. Like who's looking into what? What do we do?
Right. So, I mean, for us, you know, our first step was, okay, we found these critters here at the Arboretum. Where exactly are they? And so we did a mapping effort the first spring after, just to kind of know what we were working with, the scale of the infestation, the habitats. And then we kind of worked with the systems that we could. And one of the projects that we just got published in the journal Biological Invasions was a study looking at, okay, how... we had an earthworm invasion in some of our sugar maple-dominated forests, and we wanted to track the spread in these forests, and to see what kind of impact they had on the plant communities, on things like soil pH and litter depth, and these sort of forest floor variables. And this was a master's student project by Katie Lauschman. And what we found in that study was that in 2 years we couldn't really detect any marketable changes in the vegetation, and I say that with a caveat that could be because of several reasons. A, there weren't any. It's a real thing. They're not affecting some of these plant woodland plant species, or we just haven't. It's a new invasion, and we haven't studied it long enough.
Right.
Or these forests also have European species that have been here for a long time and might have already done the damage to the plants that are going to be affected, and so these aren't going to have much more effect. So there's some caveats there, but what we did find was that they spread in 1 year about 13 acres by themselves.
Oh, wow.
If you think of a football field, it's about 1.3 acres. And so that's quite a lot, just for a little earthworm. And then we also found out that they pretty clearly are displacing other earthworms. We basically, very few plots had both European and Asian. They were they move in and other species move out. And so we're going to be tracking this long term to try and test ask other questions about, are there long term effects versus short term effects on the litter depth and other soil properties. But that's one project that we're working on. And then just kind of quickly, other projects that we have going on. We have a postdoc that's looking at how do these critters affect tree hydraulics. So how do they affect, for example, the ability of sugar maples, which is a really common tree, obviously, to take up water nutrients to the roots? A pretty straightforward question, but obviously... given how common sugar maple is, that could have ramifications for a lot of our hardwood forests. And then a colleague of mine, Marie Johnson, and I are trying to dive into the control aspect. Are there things that we can figure out about the life cycle of this earthworm that we can disrupt that might control a population?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're specifically interested in the cocoon stage, which is... the ones that we have in North America, the earthworms are annual species, so they hatch from cocoons, which are little eggs, they're about 2 millimeters across, and they hatch in the early spring, mature throughout the year, and then when it gets to a certain temperature threshold, usually the first hard freeze, they'll die, but the cocoons will survive the winter and then hatch again in the spring. So we're trying to think about, are there abiotic factors that might limit the viability of cocoons, of the embryos in the cocoons? And so we're testing heat treatments. We're testing things like flash freezing. So we're trying to think of other ways that we can disrupt that part of the life cycle that would offer some kind of control that either, you know, landscapers could use or composters or even backyard gardens to apply a heat treatment.
Right.
at least on a small scale.
So I mean, you know, as gardeners, we have like about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk about, you know, like, okay, what do we do? I mean, I think one thing we do is most of the cooperative extensions and so forth, or university extensions in areas that have these, are interested in hearing if a homeowner has an outbreak of them. I mean, you want to know where they are, right? Like So we should report it. We should communicate with our cooperative extension, and I found that that's happening everywhere. And I've read about, you know, okay, so we could. You know, I've read crazy things like put them in plastic bags and cook them to, you know, let them cook to death in the sun and then put that in the trash and things like that. But, I mean, there's a lot of them. And like you said, they're moving 13 acres. So when I first read about them a few years ago, I thought, well, golf course managers, they've always hated those, what you say, middens, those little, you know, they've always hated that on a beautiful putting green. So they've always experimented mostly with horrendous chemicals in the years past, but nowadays it's more green. They're looking for green things. And I read that they were using something that came from the camellia plant, like a fertilizer, but I think it came from the tea plant, which is a camellia, and some kind of fertilizer made with that, but it was only available commercially, but maybe now it's available for homeowners. What avenues of control like that are you exploring?
Right. So we are, this summer actually, we're going to be doing some trials on a product that is it's sold under the organic label. It's basically a very low nitrogen-based fertilizer, but also has, like you say, extract from the tea tree oil, or I'm sorry, tea seed oil.
Tea seed, right.
Yes, yeah, and it has, which has saponins or saponins, depending on how you want to say that word, which is basically a toxin that plants produce. And it's thought that, well, and actually some of those studies, many of them were from Kentucky golf courses, have shown that they do, this fertilizer with these saponins, do greatly reduce the number of midden piles or casts that earthworms create, and which meaning that they are diminishing the population of earthworms. There hasn't been a lot done on the Asian species yet, and so that's something that we're interested in looking at, is using a liquid version of this product or a granular version, and coming up with what are the sort of minimum dosage that you would need to maybe reduce the population or get rid of the population, and also, more importantly even, what are the potential side effects.
Right.
What are the impacts to other, you know, beneficial soil biota? And that's really important, I think, before we start to, encourage folks to use one or the other controls. There's not a lot of research yet, and we're all for people trying things, but just know that there are often with controls, there's it's going to control one thing, but it's going to hurt something else.
Right.
It's going to benefit something else. There's always other factors than just the target species. That's something that we're definitely interested in.
And I think biochar is another thing, because if it's like sharp edges or something, it's another thing that's going to be explored. Is that another one?
Yep. Yeah, and there's not much in the literature on that, and I don't know a lot about biochar as a control, but I've heard that as well, that the physical properties of the biochar, especially the small granular ones that have really sharp edges, can physically be destructive to the earthworm body, which is obviously doesn't have much of a hard shell on it, and so that is an option, and it's obviously a common soil amendment anyways that many gardeners would use.
Right.
So it's an easy one to obtain.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was something that we're also interested in as well.
Well, Brad Herrick from University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, I mean, it's early stages, so it's not that you don't have the answers, it's that there are no answers yet, because you're at the forefront and colleagues at other universities around the country that are being affected this way similarly are doing this groundwork study. I mean, these are the beginning studies, right? So this is...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're going to come back and tell us what happens
absolutely.
Along the way, because we need, and we all need to learn together. And I'm going to include with the transcript, Brad, some links to some of the great articles that both of the things that you've published and also that have been written about some of the work that's been going on there. I'm so appreciative for you sort of giving us this 101 and telling us kind of where things are at about these... Asian and jumping worms, the latest invasive that I'm worried about. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Margaret.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by bestselling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
And thanks to all the rest of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or Facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.